Good day. Today is Friday, 7th November 2025. And let me remind you again, before I proceed with this programme, to tick the like button. If once you've watched the programme or that part of the programme that you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, with that, let me proceed with the rest of the programme and let me return to the topic of the American build-up around Venezuela. There are reports, an article in the Wall Street Journal, which suggests that President Trump is having second thoughts about a potential attack on Venezuela, and that he has decided to call this entire military operation, which we have been brought to the brink of, to call it off. And perhaps giving some weight to these reports is information about the USS Gerald Ford, the American carrier, which together with its escorts has been steaming towards the Caribbean, and which it is widely assumed will join the task force, the force that has been gathering in the Caribbean in preparation for what everybody believes are strikes against Venezuela. Anyway, there are reports which say that the Ford has stopped its movements. It's no longer heading towards the Caribbean. It is standing still, in effect. At any rate, it is still off the coast of Morocco, and its movements towards the Caribbean seem to have stopped for the moment. And there is speculation, there is a lot of discussion, that this reflects a decision that the president has made, Donald Trump has made, which is to call off the operation against Venezuela. And, well, there's been also a trickle of reports which I am completely unable to confirm, but which are appearing in relatively large numbers of sources, some of which are perhaps reliable, that over the last week or so, in some of these flights from Russia, which have been heading to Venezuela, some of these flights, Wagner troops have been landing in Venezuela, have been sent by Russia to Venezuela, and have been taking up positions in Venezuela in order to protect the Venezuelan government, to protect the government there. Now, if that is true, we are talking about some of the toughest, most experienced fighters in the world. Wagner has been involved in many conflicts. These are extremely experienced fighters. They played an enormous role in the conflict in Ukraine, and they are at the very least a match for any US ground troops that are deployed to Venezuela, and I suspect that they would probably be a match against US Special Forces troops as well, though I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert in that field, and I'm not here to make comparisons between various different types of light infantry units, which is what I presume the Wagner forces are. And, well, this report is not entirely implausible. I've discussed in previous programs how it would be extremely difficult for China or Russia to provide material assistance to Venezuela at this point of crisis, and why the Russians might be unwilling to supply particularly advanced military equipment to Venezuela, given the high risk that if the Venezuelan military were to collapse, this advanced equipment would fall into the possession of the United States. And I can't imagine that any deployments of Wagner troops would be sufficient to change the military calculus. They would not, it seems to me, be there in sufficient numbers to be able to defeat the United States. But one of the features of Wagner as a military organization is that precisely because it operates outside the Russian armed forces, and precisely because of the way men join Wagner on a kind of contract basis, treating it in effect as some kind of military company, private military company. Wagner, which appears to be actually under tight control of the Russian military intelligence organization, known in the West as the GRU, and the Rosgvardia organization, is well adapted to act as a kind of Russian foreign legion. It can be deployed in places around the world, and its troops are tough and experienced, but in a certain sort of way, they are expendable as well. Because they're not part of the Russian military, if Wagner troops were to fight American troops in Venezuela, it would not be a direct clash between the armed forces of the two superpowers. So there is some logic in sending Wagner troops to Venezuela. Let me stress again, I don't know that this is the case. And though they cannot be enough to redress the military balance in favour of the Maduro government, they might be capable of doing certain things which might conceivably cause the United States to take a step back and pause. For example, Wagner troops might be able to protect certain facilities in Venezuela. I can't imagine that they would be able to protect the oil fields, which must be spread out across a huge territory. And I don't know how many Wagner troops would have been sent to Venezuela, but I can't imagine that it's more than a couple of hundred at most. But they could perhaps defend or protect some particularly important facilities. And of course, they could also provide protection to the Venezuelan leadership, to people like Maduro and his top officials. And they could also possibly act as a factor strengthening the morale of the wider Venezuelan military in a confrontation as well. So if there are plans, if part of the American plans was to seize Maduro himself and to seize certain critical facilities in Venezuela, then the presence of the Wagner troops would indeed be a significant complicating factor, and it might be a reason for delay on the part of the United States. However, we must be very careful. I don't for a fact know that there are Wagner troops in Venezuela. Reports that they are there exist, but of course confirmation is limited. And in other respects, it's very difficult to say, to see how even the deployment of Wagner troops would be enough in and of itself and by itself to deter the United States. There might be other reasons why the president specifically might be minded to call this operation off. There have been, as everyone knows, elections in various US states and, of course, in New York. These elections have gone badly against the president and the Republican Party. It is widely agreed that the Venezuelan operation is deeply unpopular with President Trump's Republican base. There are growing criticisms from his base of President Trump. I read a long article just before I started making this program in the American Conservative, which makes the point that he is increasingly sounding and behaving like he was George W. Bush rather than the America First leader that he presented himself to be. And it could be that the president, alarmed about the deterioration of his support in the United States, is now having second thoughts and is calling this operation off. I would like to believe so anyway. However, there must be some contrary points made against this as well. Firstly, it's important to make the point that this could all be part of a deception operation. It seems to me that the United States already has more than enough forces in the region to conduct an operation against Venezuela without the participation of the Gerald Ford. There are already F-35 fighter jets deployed to local bases. There are very powerful Aegis-class destroyers in the area. There's amphibious warfare ships. I would have thought that the United States could carry out an operation without the Gerald Ford. And it may be that all this talk about the Gerald Ford and the article in the Wall Street Journal is part of an elaborate deception operation to make us think that an attack on Venezuela has been called off, whereas, of course, in reality, it might be about to happen. And all of these reports in the Wall Street Journal and the mysteries about the Gerald Ford's movements might be intended to induce in Venezuela, on the part of Maduro and his officials, a false sense of security. This is not impossible. It is very much part, it would be very much part of the pattern that the Trump administration has shown over the last few months. For example, the elaborate fiction that the United States was about to negotiate with Iran on Iran's nuclear enrichment program and the setting up of a meeting in Oman to do precisely that, even as Israel and the United States were preparing to attack Iran. So we cannot discount the possibility that this is a deception operation and that the president remains committed to the attack on Venezuela that I've discussed in previous programs. It continues to be my view that in one form or another, sooner or later, such an attack will indeed come. To repeat again a point I have made several times, deploying such powerful forces off the coast of Venezuela, cranking up the rhetoric against the Maduro government to the extent that has now happened, would be extremely difficult at this point to walk back from. If the president were indeed to call off the entire operation, withdraw the fleet, and the fleet cannot remain in Caribbean waters indefinitely, too large a part of US naval forces is committed to this operation. And the cost of keeping the US Navy in the Caribbean by itself would, I would have thought, make keeping it there without doing anything with it indefinitely impractical, the Navy itself at some point would start to complain. I can't imagine that that would be done. And it seems to me that the embarrassment of calling the fleet back, leaving Maduro still in power, still in control in Caracas and Venezuela, able to boast that he has called America's bluff. Well, I don't think that this president and this administration are going to let that happen. So, one way or another, I still believe that an attack on Venezuela is about to come. It may be, as I said, that we are looking at a deception operation, or it may be that reports about the presence of Wagner troops is making the United States reassess and recalibrate some of its plans. But I still can't quite believe, though I would love to believe, that this whole operation has in fact been called off. Anyway, this is all I'm going to say about the Venezuelan situation for the moment. We will see how and if things have changed. What I would say, by the way, is that if it was indeed the presence of Wagner forces in Venezuela that have changed the entire direction of policy in the United States, of the United States, and which have resulted in the regime change operation against Venezuela being called off, then that will be a very important fact. It will mean that the Russians, certainly the Russians, are now in a position to exert force on the ground in Latin America in ways that has never happened before, not even in Cuba, just to say. Anyway, this is where I'm going to, as I say, end my discussion about Venezuela. We will see over the next couple of days or week or so what exactly the administration and the president decide to do. Now, I devoted a large part of my program yesterday to a discussion of an important meeting that took place in Moscow by the Security Council, in which they discussed at length President Trump's comments about the United States resuming nuclear testing, and which resulted in a decision by the Russians, confirmed by Putin over the course of this meeting in the Security Council, to prepare for the imminent possibility of Russia itself resuming nuclear testing. Now, there has been a follow-up meeting to that meeting in Moscow, the meeting that I discussed yesterday. There has been a follow-up meeting which apparently is taking place or has taken place early today. And this is a meeting also presumably held within the structures of Russia's Security Council about development, as they put it, of the armed forces. Now, about this meeting, the Kremlin is providing us with no information or very little information. It's not giving us transcripts or a readout, and we're only given what I suspect is a very limited overview, a very limited account of who the participants in this meeting were. The Kremlin says that the meeting was attended by Putin. Putin chaired it, obviously, and there's a picture of him chairing the meeting, I'll return to that picture in a moment, but was attended by Deputy Chairman of the Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, Defence Minister Andrei Belousov, Director of the Federal Security Service, that's the FSB, Alexander Bortnikov, Chief of the General Staff of Russia's Armed Forces, First Deputy Minister of Defence, Valery Gerasimov, and Presidential Aide, Alexei Dumin. Dumin is a rising figure in the Kremlin. He has a background as a special forces officer in the Russian military. He was for some years governor of Tula region, a region in Russia which is a major location of large parts of Russia's military industrial complex. And some time ago he was brought to Moscow. He was made a member of Putin's team. There are some people who believe that one day he will be president of Russia. Just saying. But anyway, he participates in these meetings, and he's clearly somebody who should be watched, and he's clearly somebody who is involved in military decision-making at various levels. I have heard, by the way, that he played a major role in organising the successful Russian defence in Kursk region after the Ukrainian incursion into Kursk region in August of last year, and that he was basically in charge of the Russian special forces there. So it is interesting that Dumin is at this meeting. It's perhaps worth pointing out who else was there. So Medvedev was there. That makes complete sense because Medvedev is the deputy chairman of the Military Industrial Commission. So he is the man who is ultimately responsible for Russia's military industrial complex. Belousov is, of course, the defence minister. Gerasimov is the chief of the general staff. Bortnikov heads Russia's counter-intelligence agencies. I am sure that many other people attended this meeting, probably military officers. The photograph, the only photograph of this meeting that the Kremlin has produced, shows Putin at the table with Medvedev, Dumin and Belousov sitting to the right of him. But it's clear that there are many other people at the table, and for some reason the Russians are very careful to avoid telling us who they are. That suggests not just military officers, but people from the military industrial complex and perhaps scientists who are also involved in development of new Russian weapons, about which the Russians want to preserve the highest degree of secrecy. So we see that the Kremlin, the Russian government, is engaging in a whole series of meetings, reviewing the state of the military and perhaps planning further developments, further military developments in connection with the information that they're receiving about actions being taken by the United States. Now, I should say that at this time of year, towards the end of the calendar year, it is actually routine for the Kremlin to have meetings discussing military industrial developments. If you go back last year, you will see that Putin also chaired a whole series of meetings at that time, reviewing the state of the Russian armed forces, technological and industrial developments, and things of that kind. So in the in itself, the fact that these meetings are taking place and that they're taking place now is not new. The format, or rather the way in which the Kremlin is informing us about these meetings, is, however, different. We had the strange appearance of a discussion yesterday, of an impromptu discussion about nuclear weapons testing. And I discussed in my programme yesterday that, in fact, that discussion bore all the hallmarks of having been very carefully choreographed. In fact, I've heard a suggestion that the actual meeting discussing nuclear testing took place earlier, and that the meeting that I discussed in my programme yesterday was merely a choreographed performance, basically to inform Russians and the Americans and the world of decisions that had been made following an earlier discussion held on the same day, which had been kept secret. Just saying. Anyway, there was this strange meeting yesterday, and we have this meeting which is taking place today, about which we are being provided, well, basically minimal information, except the fact that it is taking place. And, well, I've also received some comment about Lavrov's absence from the meeting that took place yesterday. Now, this has been discussed in the Russian media. Kommersant, the Russian newspaper, has run an article about this, wondering whether there might be some issues about Lavrov, whether perhaps Putin is unhappy with Lavrov because of the way that Lavrov conducted the telephone conversation with Rubio, and that Lavrov is in some sort of disfavour. This has been seized on in the West, by the way. There's an article, for example, in the Daily Telegraph that makes the same speculation. The Kremlin, however, has emphatically denied this story, as has the Russian Foreign Ministry. The Foreign Ministry spokesman has said that all Western accounts of the Lavrov-Rubio call are fictitious and a disinformation exercise, and the implication is that there's no reason at all to think that Lavrov is in any form of disfavour. And Putin's spokesman, Peskov, without explaining Lavrov's absence from the meeting yesterday, so that all speculation that Lavrov is in disfavour with Putin is completely wrong. I've already said that the reports that have appeared in the West about what happened over the course of Lavrov's conversation with Rubio are obviously and completely wrong and fictitious. And I said yesterday that Lavrov's absence from yesterday's meeting should in no way be construed in itself as suggesting that Lavrov is in any kind of trouble or disfavour. I mean, it's perhaps worth bearing in mind that Lavrov is 76. We are now in autumn. It's a time of colds and flus and virus infections. It's not impossible that Lavrov is unwell, and that was the reason why he stayed away from the meeting yesterday. But there isn't another possibility that has been suggested to me, which I think is plausible, but which, if true, is very disturbing. And that takes us back to the number of people, the very senior people who attended yesterday's meeting. Everybody of importance involved in military industrial decision making was present. Putin, the speakers of the two houses of the Russian parliament, Medvedev, Mishustin, the prime minister, the heads of the intelligence agencies, Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, Shoigu, the secretary of the Security Council, Belousov, the defense minister. And it's been suggested to me that the reason that Lavrov was not there was that the Russians are now taking precautions so that if there had been an attack on the Kremlin whilst this meeting was underway, and bear in mind that Zelensky has threatened attacks to decapitate the Russian leadership, that somebody would be kept in a position of safety to take immediate charge following such an attack if the rest of the leadership were killed or incapacitated. And, well, Lavrov would indeed be an obvious such person. Now, if that is true, and again, this is speculation, then this is extremely disturbing development. Indeed, it seems that Lavrov is also not participating in this meeting, which is taking place today. It means that the Russians feel that international tensions are now rising to extremely dangerous levels, to the point that they're having to take these kind of precautions against possible decapitation strikes on their leadership. And, well, I think that given the topics of discussion, the military strategies of the world's biggest nuclear power, if the Russians do feel as concerned and as worried as this, and are taking these sort of precautions, then we should be very, very worried as well. Anyway, I'm not going to speculate further about this because, of course, I don't fully know what is actually happening and whether things really are as bad as that. Bear in mind, as I said, that it's not impossible that Lavrov has flu and that he's staying away from these meetings for that reason and for no other. Or, of course, it could be that he's away on some private meeting or some secret meeting. Maybe he's in China or in Iran. Who knows? I mean, he is the sort of person who perhaps might be expected to do these things. Anyway, let's move on, and let's now return to the perennial topic of these programmes, which is, of course, the topic which, in a kind of a sense, provides the background to all the things we've just been discussing. And that is the situation in Ukraine. And there's been a whole cascade of further developments on the battlefronts, which have come out over the last 24 hours. So let me begin by talking about Zaporozhye region, because this morning the Russian Defense Ministry confirmed that the fortified village of Uspenivka in the Zaporozhye region has now been captured by the Russian armed forces. There's been a report about this in TASS. It says footage obtained by TASS showed fighters from the 218th Guards Tank Regiment of the 127th Division belonging to Battle Group East's 5th Army, advancing with maximum stealth to the Yanshuo River before crossing it, afterwards they passed through Uspenivka under drone cover on their way to the southwestern outskirts. We can see how the enemy's defence in this sizeable locality has collapsed, despite the presence of a water barrier and exposed approaches. The enemy's defences have effectively crumbled. And there was another report in TASS which spoke of Ukrainian troops fleeing from Uspenivka. And as I said, the Russian Defense Ministry says that Uspenivka has now passed completely under Russian control. Now, that leaves no barrier that I am aware of between the Russians and the main supply road to the town of Guliapolye in Zaporozhye, which lies further to the west. And I should say that there are also reports of further Russian advances somewhat to the north of this territory, also in Zaporozhye region, with reports that the Russians are now beginning the operation of storming another important village in this area, Velikomikhailovka, the capture of which would also open the way for the Russians to advance to this supply road, though somewhat further to the north. Now, all of this brings us very much closer to the moment when Guliapolye itself, an important town in Zaporozhye region, and a historic town in Russian history, by the way, when Guliapolye itself will be encircled by the Russians and placed under siege. And of course, if the supply lines to Guliapolye are cut, and we are perhaps approaching that moment, then we're talking about another cauldron in another important town in Ukraine. And bear in mind that Guliapolye and Orekhov are the only two towns in Zaporozhye region, apart from the great city of Zaporozhye itself, which the Russians don't currently control. If they capture Guliapolye and they capture Orekhov, and most people believe, I think rightly, that if Guliapolye falls, Orekhov will soon follow. Well, if that happens, the entirety of Zaporozhye region basically falls under Russian control, and the only stretch of territory in Zaporozhye region which would still remain under Ukrainian control would be the city of Zaporozhye on the Dnieper, which would, however, be deprived of its hinterland. So this is an important event, the fall of Uspenivka, and we can see that it is bringing us closer to a major military crisis for Ukraine when the Russians reach the Dnieper in the Zaporozhye area as well. So this is one important piece of news, but arguably the single most important news on the battlefronts comes from the Pokrovsk and Kupiansk areas. Now let's begin with Kupiansk, because we've had a number of comments now from Russian military commanders who are located in Kupiansk. And they've been providing this information again to the Russian news agency TASS. And we are told that a commander of an assault group of the 1486th Motorized Rifle Regiment of the Russian Army, a commander by the name who is got a call sign, which is Lovets, has told TASS that the Russians have mopped up the premises of a compound feed factory and liberated seven more buildings, and that they have less than 50 buildings left to clear out in Kupiansk's eastern part. And then there's a direct quote from Lovets, this commander. The group continues to carry out tasks on liberating the eastern part of Kupiansk. The enemy tries to resist. Today we eliminated another two groups, numbering a total of 8 enemy soldiers. We liberated 7 buildings and completed the mop-up of the premises of a compound feed factory. We continue to advance in my section in the town's eastern part. Less than 50 buildings are left to be cleared. Now, all of this is a little vague, and I'm not quite sure where all this is supposed to be happening. But the references to this happening in eastern Kupiansk suggest that it is taking place on the east bank of the Oskol River. In the area, in other words, where the Ukrainian troops have been encircled. In other words, inside the cauldron itself. And this apparently relatively junior commander believes that there's only 50 buildings still to capture in the area of his responsibility, and that the end of the battle for Kupiansk is in sight. Then an entirely different commander, this one who has the call sign Lavrik, has told TASS, Battle Group West is expecting to fully liberate Kupiansk within the coming week. Lavrik, the commander of the assault unit of the 121st Regiment of the 68th Motorized Division, has told TASS. So that's according to TASS. And again, we have a direct quote. My unit is carrying out the task of clearing and liberating Kupiansk. Over the past day, we have liberated 25 buildings in the city. That is a very large number of buildings to be captured in one place. In its western part, I presume this refers to territory south of the main residential area on the west bank of the Oskol River. In its western part, my soldiers advanced along 3 streets, liberating 16 buildings. 9 houses were liberated on Pervaya Zapadnaya Street, 4 on Levadny Vyezd Street, and 3 on Sinkovskaya Street. Our neighbours are also doing well. They have liberated another 9 buildings at a feed mill. I wonder that the feed mill is the compound feed factory that Lovets, the previous commander, was telling us. In which case, we can see a parallel advance by the Russians on the east and west bank of the Oskol River, with these two advances perhaps supporting each other. And then Lavrik, and I would stress this is obviously not his real name, this is his call sign, continues to say, we continue to advance on the right bank. There are still about 130 buildings left. I am confident that Kupiansk will be completely liberated within the next week. Our morale is high and we will accomplish our mission. So perhaps a week, other reports have said 5 days before Kupiansk falls entirely under the control of the Russians. Now, there's been all kinds of claims from Zelensky that, on the contrary, it is the Ukrainians who are advancing and winning in Kupiansk. In fact, he actually claims that the Ukrainians have won the battle of Kupiansk, and that in fact all that needs to happen is for the Ukrainians to clear up, to mop up the 60 remaining Russian troops who are still in Kupiansk. Well, we see that Russian soldiers on the ground are giving a completely different account of the battle. And as I've explained on several occasions, I have no doubt that it is the Russians who are giving the more accurate account of the battle. It looks as if, from what these two commanders, infantry commanders, Russian infantry commanders, Lavets and Lavrik, are saying, that the Battle of Kupiansk is mostly ended. Anyway, that's Kupiansk. Now, Pokrovsk is obviously a much bigger place, and the battle there is more complicated, but the Russian Defense Ministry has provided its own account of the fact of the fighting in Pokrovsk. It says, in Pokrovsk, assault detachments of the Second Army continued to eliminate encircled Ukrainian troops in the eastern part of the Tsentralny neighborhood and on the territory of the industrial area to the west. Ukrainian troops are being mopped up in Gnatovka and Rog. There are reports, by the way, that Rog has now been captured since this report was made. Again, I can't confirm that. 45 buildings were liberated over the past 24 hours. And as I've said, 45 buildings is a large number of buildings to fall in a short time. It suggests that resistance is crumbling. And remember that in my program yesterday, I mentioned that the Russians had claimed to have captured 64 buildings in Pokrovsk and in the area of Pokrovsk over a period of 24 hours, and that also suggested a crumbling defense. And then the Russian Defense Ministry continues, 11 enemy attacks to release encircled Ukrainian troops launched from Grishino were repelled. Ukrainian troops of the 32nd Mechanized Brigade, with support of a tank, attempted to break through the encirclement to the north. So that suggests that this is an attempt by Ukrainian troops within the Pokrovsk cauldron, again, to break out. And the Defense Ministry says, as a result of a precise drone strike, the Ukrainian T-72 tank was destroyed and the enemy's manpower was suppressed by small arms and artillery fire. And then they talk about the situation in Mirnograd. Units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade, as part of the 51st Army, liberated 24 buildings in Mirnograd and continue resolute offensive actions in the direction of the Zabadny neighborhood. Over the past week, the enemy made 45 attempts to release the encircled group of Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and 32 attempts to break through the encirclement. And all of these attempts failed. And again, according to the Defense Ministry, Ukrainian losses amounted to more than 1,460 troops. This is over the period of the last week in the Pokrovsk area. Bear in mind that the Russians originally claimed that the number of Ukrainian troops encircled in Pokrovsk was around 5,500. Anyway, there it is. I should say that Julian Repke, the German journalist of Bild Zeitung, has made further scathing comments about various Ukrainian claims about successful counterattacks inside Pokrovsk. He's posted this comment on X. Why does not a single geolocation in or around Pokrovsk indicate that any sort of Ukrainian counteroffensive is successfully taking place somewhere in the city area. And no, hosting a flag at a building that was never under Russian control is not a successful counteroffensive. So that was said by Julian Röpke, and perhaps we ought to take what he says seriously, because after all, he is both well informed and very sympathetic to Ukraine. So anyway, there it is. So all the indications that the Russian Defense Ministry is giving of a crisis in Pokrovsk. And we've had video footage supplied by the Ukrainians, interestingly, basically of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian positions. And these locate Russian troops at the northern and western and eastern extremities of Pokrovsk. It's very difficult to believe that the Ukrainians really now control any part of Pokrovsk in any coherent way. Probably there are small locations dotted around Pokrovsk where there are still Ukrainian troops. Reports started to circulate this morning that the Russians are not just sending infantry into Pokrovsk now, but also motor vehicles, trucks, perhaps armoured vehicles as well. The kind that strongly suggests that the Russians are now confident about the overall strength of their control of Pokrovsk. And of course, if armoured vehicles are being sent, they would obviously be used or intended to be used to clear pockets of resistance, to flush Ukrainian defenders out of specific buildings. Anyway, that's the information from Pokrovsk. And we've seen that in Kupiansk, the reports claim, the Russians are saying that they expect the battle of Kupiansk to be over within a week. And by the way, Lavrik's post has now also been republished by the Russian Defense Ministry. And so that appears to give the Russian Defense Ministry's endorsement to his words. And, well, it looks as if the Pokrovsk situation is equally critical. The Ukrainians, it seems, have been mostly pushed out of Pokrovsk, apart from, as I said, from these small groups that are isolated within the town. There are still some Ukrainian troops in control, in proper control, of parts of Mirnograd, but the cauldron, the territory of the cauldron, continues to shrink, and it's only a matter of time now before the defense in both Pokrovsk and Mirnograd collapses as well. So, well, this is now clearly being picked up in the United States too, because we've now had a succession of articles in the US media about the critical situation in Pokrovsk. I've noticed that the American media avoids references to Kupiansk. They focus exclusively on Pokrovsk. I mentioned one of these articles yesterday in my program, which is the article that appeared in the Washington Post, but there's now been articles, very similar articles, in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal. And all of these articles taken together give me the very strong impression of being part of a concerted campaign organised by agencies of the United States government. And they're doing, it seems to me, two things. Firstly, they are, all of them, telling Zelensky, look, Pokrovsk is lost. Forget about defending Pokrovsk. Get your troops out. Accept that you've lost Pokrovsk. Order the retreat. In reality, based on everything that I've seen about the situation on the ground, I think the time to retreat from Pokrovsk is gone. It would have been perhaps possible 2 weeks ago, but I think now, in all practical terms, it has become impossible. The Defense Ministry said that there were 45 attempts to try to break into Pokrovsk by the Ukrainian military and that they were all repelled, and 32 attempts by the Ukrainian troops to withdraw from Pokrovsk and they were repelled also. And by the way, there is really harrowing video footage of a group of Ukrainian soldiers trying to escape the cauldron, fleeing towards the village of Grishinyo, being detected by the Russians. It's the Russians who have provided us with this video footage. And these soldiers desperately running across the woods and the fields towards Grishinyo. As far as I could see, having thrown away their weapons, suddenly being attacked by the Russians with small arms and ammunition and mortars and drones. And, well, I'm not going to describe what happened because it was all very distressing both to see and to discuss. So anyway, I think it's too late to withdraw from Pokrovsk, but the fact that the United States is advising Zelensky to do that shows that the United States recognises that the battle is lost. And all of these articles, by the way, also do the same thing. They all try to minimise the importance of Pokrovsk. They claim that if the Russians capture Pokrovsk, it's essentially a propaganda victory, that Pokrovsk has no very great military significance. Yes, it is true that the Ukrainians have said that if Pokrovsk falls, it's open country, basically, until the Russians reach Pavlograd, and Pavlograd might be undefendable or difficult to defend. And then beyond Pavlograd is the Dnieper, and the fall of Pokrovsk could lead to the entire loss of Dnipropetrovsk region. So, I mean, these articles do acknowledge this, but, you know, they don't seem to be especially bothered about it. And, of course, they repeat the trope that Pokrovsk is a very small place of no very great significance, that Pokrovsk has cost the Russians vast numbers of men to capture. Of course, there's no actual corroboration of this. This is just a theme that is endlessly repeated. And that, well, one article said it's the only significant Russian gain since the fall of Avdiivka 2 years ago. Now, the latter claim, which appears in the headline, I believe, of the New York Times article, from memory, from the New York Times article, I have to say that left me gasping. Certainly, the Russians captured Avdiivka in February 2024. So, yes, that was almost 2 years ago. But to suggest that the Russians have captured no other important place since then is preposterous. Firstly, they've driven the Ukrainians out of Kursk region, and recaptured the town of Suja. And that was an important battle, which this article sort of evades. It's careful to say, I noticed, that it was the Pokrovsk would be the first important capture by the Russians in Ukraine in the last 2 years since the fall of Avdiivka. It's fascinating to me to see how Ukraine's entire operation in Kursk, its disastrous 6 month offensive there, has been completely vanished down a memory hole as far as the Western media are concerned. They don't talk about it at all. It's as if it never happened. Anyway, they put aside what happened in Kursk, disaster, what that was. But it isn't even true that the Russians have not captured important places in other important other places since the fall of Avdiivka. What about Toretsk, Chasiv Yar, Krasnogorivka, Selidovo, Kupiansk, Ugledar? These places don't exist. A more accurate way of describing the situation is that with the fall of Pokrovsk and the fall of Liman and Siversk, which is likely to follow fairly soon, that will leave only two places of importance in Donbass left. And these are, of course, the towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And I've already discussed the immense difficulties of defending these places if Pokrovsk is lost and if Liman and Izium and Kupiansk north of Slavyansk are lost. And it's difficult to see the battle to defend Donbass being successful for very much longer. The Ukrainians themselves, despite the brave and heroic language that's coming from Zelensky, which clearly nobody takes very seriously, not even Ukraine itself, are starting to recognise that they're about to lose Donbass. And they've taken the first step to show that this is the case. Yesterday, the Ukrainian railways confirmed that they are ending all rail links. They're closing all of the rail links to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. So it is no longer possible to go by train to these two towns in Donbass from Ukraine. If Zelensky wants to visit them, he has to go there by car. Now, that is a very important development in itself. It shows that the Ukrainians already realise that the railways are at risk. The trains, supply trains, heading to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk could be targeted by Russian drones, that the Russians are close enough to those two towns to be able to do that. I spoke, I think, 2 days ago about how Russian drone operators are apparently already sending their drones to intercept Ukrainian road traffic between Slavyansk and the town of Izium in Kharkiv region. But it looks as if the Russians are now able to, or at least the Ukrainian railway authorities fear that the Russians can also interfere with the trains heading to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west. So it shows, in a sense, how close the Russians actually are to imposing a siege on these two towns. But in effect, the siege is already underway, because the major way in which supplies are sent to towns or to forces on the ground is by train in this war. Both the Russians and the Ukrainians rely on the railways to keep their men supplied on the battlefronts. And if we're talking about artillery ammunition, it is by train that most of the shells are conveyed so that they can reach the battlefront. So anyway, clearly a military crisis, and one which has deepened over the last few hours, with even the United States beginning to understand, or starting to understand, that perhaps the fairy tales that Zelensky was telling them in the summer, that Ukraine was not just holding its own, but was actually winning, were untrue, and that Russian claims that it was they who were advancing and who were soon going to capture Donbass, it was those claims that are really true. Now, that might explain why there's been some comments from American officials that might suggest that the United States is again looking to reopen some kind of dialogue with the Russians. So Donald Trump has again spoken about how he's had a long conversation with Putin recently, and how Putin told him about the many attempts that Putin had made to find a negotiated solution to the Ukrainian conflict. But don't worry, Trump is now on the job, and that negotiated solution would come. Witkoff, Trump's negotiator with the Russians, has made certain rather sour comments of his own. He spoke about the collapse of trust between the Russians and the Ukrainians, and how this has made all efforts to achieve a solution impossible. And by the way, Peskov, Putin's spokesman, agreed with him. Peskov said, "Today the main thing that has slowed down the settlement process is that the pause that emerged over Ukraine's reluctance to follow the path of finding a political and diplomatic solution, and over the Europeans provoking the Kiev regime to continue hostilities." And he went on to say, "There is no mutual trust whatsoever to speak of between Moscow and Kiev. That is not a deficit in trust, but its absence." So, Peskov, these words suggest that if the Americans are intent on reviving attempts to perhaps go back to the proposals in Alaska, the proposal that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass in return for the Russians agreeing to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, if that was the proposal that the Americans made in August in Alaska. Anyway, they may find that this time, judging from the rather chilly response from Peskov, that the Russians are a lot less interested. There is not a deficit in trust, but its absence. The Russians don't trust Zelensky. They don't trust the Ukrainians. Peskov made these comments specifically in response to the comments that Witkoff has made. I can't help but think that when he says that there is an absence of trust, he extends that to the Americans as well, which, given all that has happened over the last few months, Witkoff coming with a proposal to Moscow in August, Putin agreeing to meet Trump in Alaska in August, Putin telling Trump that he agreed with the proposal that Witkoff and Trump were floating, the Americans then going back on all of that and talking about sending missiles, Tomahawk missiles, to Ukraine, and then pulling out of a summit meeting in Budapest, which they had proposed, and slapping sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. It seems to me that what Peskov is saying here is that, sorry, it's not just the Ukrainians we don't trust. We don't trust you, the Americans, either. We had that moment in Alaska to do the deal. It was the deal that you proposed, and you threw it all away. You dithered. You listened to what Zelensky was saying. You believed his lies, or pretended that you did. You listened to what the Europeans were saying. We don't see any sign that the Europeans are changing their stance. And we're not prepared to go down this route of negotiations with you again, because the trust has completely gone. Now, if I'm right in thinking that, then the Alaska debacle is going to be remembered in history as one of the catastrophic wrong turns that has been taken over the course of this crisis between Russia and the West that has developed in connection with Ukraine. There have been many, as Putin apparently told Trump, the summit meeting, the NATO summit in Bucharest, where basically Ukraine was told by NATO to apply for NATO membership. That was one decisive moment. The Minsk Agreement of 2015 was another such moment. Perhaps Alaska will be remembered as the most, as the darkest moment of all, the moment when it was still possible to turn things round, but when the opportunity was thrown away. There is no sign, no glimmer of a sign, that this is understood in Europe. There are reports that the British government is supplying more Storm Shadow missiles to Ukraine, a completely pointless thing to do. The Storm Shadows have proved mostly unsuccessful in Ukraine. The Russians long ago showed that they are able to defeat them. So why the British government continues to send them, I can't think. The British government is going to send to Ukraine whatever self-propelled guns the British Army still has left, apparently. I understood that there were hardly any left, but whatever number there still are, the British are going to send it. The European Union is still trying to find some means to put funds together to send to Ukraine. The Belgian government is resisting, is continuing to resist all proposals to provide Ukraine with a 140 billion euro loan linked in some way to the frozen Russian assets. The European Commission has still not given up on this idea, and they're having more meetings with the Belgians. But other European governments have conspicuously refused to assure Belgium that they're prepared to share liability with Belgium if this decision to supply this loan to Ukraine goes badly wrong, because courts around the world decide to side with Russia over its legality. I would just quickly say one further thing here. I've already discussed in various programmes how the very fact that the European Commission and Friedrich Merz have come up with a scheme to justify what is in effect confiscation of the Russian assets in itself highlights the illegality of the enterprise and the fact that the Europeans themselves realise that what they're proposing to do is illegal. This huge argument that has raged between Belgium and the other European governments and the European Commission over the last few weeks over this very issue has highlighted that illegality even further. Clearly, Belgium believes that this would be an illegal move. Otherwise, it wouldn't be making these objections. And European governments obviously also believe or fear that this was an illegal move, because if they thought that it wasn't, they would presumably have no difficulty sharing liability with Belgium for any massive judgments made by international courts against Euroclear, the depository which is based in Belgium. All of this is grist for the mill for Russia's lawyers if this case is ever brought. The Europeans, perhaps they don't realise this, but through holding this complex discussion, have already weakened what was already, in my opinion, a threadbare case. And it just highlighted further still that they understand fully how illegal this enterprise actually is. Anyway, they're now saying that the situation is critical, that the IMF might withhold support. I've discussed already how in that event, and in the event that funding for Ukraine stops, that could lead to a financial crisis in Ukraine and perhaps hyperinflation there. Some of Ukraine's creditors are beginning to have cold feet. There was an article in the Financial Times that said that some of these creditors have refused to roll over more of Ukraine's debt, despite Ukraine offering them attractive terms, including money up front to do so. It suggests to me that they are already now worrying about some kind of default, and they don't want to compromise their legal positions in advance of it. Anyway, the European Commission, I don't think it's yet given up on this loan idea, but they're apparently now floating again the idea of raising money for Ukraine through the device of Eurobonds. And this probably explains why there are reports that over the last few days, France and Italy have also joined Belgium in opposing the 140 billion euro loan idea secured on the Russian assets. Now, it should be said that both France and Italy have been skeptics about this proposal anyway. And about a week ago, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, provided cogent arguments why it might not be a good idea. But I can't help but think that one of the reasons that France and Italy are keen to are arguing against the loan idea is because they're keen instead to go for Eurobonds. And the reason they want to go for Eurobonds is because, of course, they always supported Eurobonds. Eurobonds are an attractive way of getting Germany and other creditor states within the EU to start taking on European Union debt, including the debt of the highly indebted countries within the European Union, which of course now include France and Italy. So given the choice between a massively dubious, undoubtedly illegal loan to Ukraine, drawn on assets that belong to someone else, which is Russia, and Eurobonds, of course they're going to support Eurobonds. The big question then is what Friedrich Merz and the German government are going to say. Now, I can predict completely what German public opinion would say about this idea. They would overwhelmingly oppose it. So would public opinion in other creditor states, the Netherlands, Finland, Slovakia, of course. They would oppose it staunchly as well. Ultimately, it really does come down to Merz and his coalition partners. They strike me as the sort of people who will do pretty much anything they think they can get away with to continue to support Ukraine. But it may be that given the current mood in Ukraine, Eurobonds is just a step too far. We'll just have to wait and see. It's, I think, going to be a toss-up. Merz has already shown that he's got no aversion to debt. He's spending money at a phenomenal rate. It's not helping the German economy. The latest figures show that Germany is slipping deeper and deeper into recession. And the industrial recession in Germany certainly is deepening fast. So Merz himself, despite all of that, probably would still be happy to, well, borrow another 140 billion and use it to fund Ukraine. I can't imagine, as I said, that he's going to have any principled aversion to this. But German public opinion will be strongly opposed. The SPD might support it. The Greens, of course, would support it. But probably there would be a significant group within the CDU and the CSU, in other words, within Merz's own parties, who were strongly opposed. And, well, we'll see whether or not Merz is prepared to take them on and prevail against them and risk negative judgments about this from the German Constitutional Court. Anyway, this is where we are. We are looking at a major crisis on the battlefronts. The Russians, as the two meetings, the meeting yesterday and the meeting today in Moscow are showing, have lost trust and confidence in the Trump administration. They're now increasingly coming round to thinking of it as an enemy. The prospect for a negotiated resolution of the Ukrainian conflict, I think, has melted away. I think it's going to be very difficult to turn the dial back to Alaska after what has happened over the last few weeks. The Europeans remain committed to continuing the war. So do the British. Zelensky, of course, is in total denial about the realities on the battlefield. They have no plan. There is no plan to change the outcome of the war. But despite that, the war, as far as they are concerned, must go on, even if the risk is a financial collapse in Ukraine and an even bigger military defeat next year, which is now becoming all too likely. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Don't forget also to check out our new Substack page. Remember too to check out our shop. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.